from NPR and The Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. While the president readies for his push on immigration reform, Republicans regroup in Florida.
Those that were at the Miami meeting, they had been sounding the alarm among the GOP about the Latino problem for months. So this was sort of like, I told you so, now let's do something about it meeting.
Plus diversity in the cabinet, or the lack of it. More news analysis from Victor Landa of News Taco. And in Miami, a guayabera maker who tailors tradition to the young and hip.
People feel elegant without using a suit.
Now, get your engines revved. We're going low riding with the unique ladies of San Diego.
Don't assume that because I decided to have tattoos on my body or I decide to drive this particular type of vehicle that I am lesser a person than you are.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. A surge of new media platforms like blogs has brought more opportunities for Latinos to report about themselves instead of being reported on. But new media is constantly changing, and will Latino bloggers be able to withstand the new challenges this brings about? Megan Ortiz is the publisher of Vivid Latino. She's been following the changes, and she joins us from her home in Los Angeles, California. Welcome to Latino USA, Megan.
Thanks, Maria. Great to be on.
Your post basically said, Latinos in new media on the verge of a breakthrough or a breakdown. ¡Oy, qué dramática! What exactly do you mean? Which one is it, breakthrough or breakdown?
I mean, I think it really depends what perspective you're coming from. In the article that I wrote for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, I talked to Latino bloggers who had been blogging since the late 1990s, the early 2000s, and what they and myself have been seeing is a sort of shift in how blogging has developed. Not only are we competing with micro-platforms like Twitter and Tumblr, but also we're competing with huge corporate interests, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but we also are seeing some of the independent voices that really made blogging what it was sort of being watered down. We have Latino bloggers who traditionally worked independently not being able to because of the competition, or they're being paid by these bigger companies. So in some ways, it's good because we get more exposure, but also we're losing a lot of independent voices.
Because what you think happens is that when a Latino writer signs on to a larger corporate market, then they basically are being edited by people who are not Latino and who don't have that authenticity?
Well, it's not necessarily that, but it's that they don't get to dictate anymore what they write about. So when you're writing for a larger corporate entity, you're basically following lots of market trends. And let's face it, being Latino is hotter than ever now. Even traditional news media sites who have been considered anti-Latino because of some of their anti-immigrant and basically racist positions that they put forward have a sort of side Latino income stream. So it's not so much about being watered down. It's about not being able to talk about the stories that are really happening from the point of view of Latinos.
So in the article that you wrote for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, you mentioned that bloggers have noted a decrease in audience numbers and participation. So what's going on here?
Well, I think part of it is the increased competition. So you have a lot more Latino content out there, which is not a bad thing. It's wonderful. There's a lot more diverse voices. What happened in the late 1990s and early 2000s is there were like two or three gatos blogging. So it was easier to get that audience. But now, because there's so many more Latinos blogging right now, there's much more competition. There seems to be a favoring of, you know, platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, where the information's coming much more rapid fire, whereas blogging still favors a longer form.
I just love that notion of savoring the times when blogging was deep and long-winded. What about, for example, if blogging is moving on to something else, microblogging, how is all of this affecting how Latino issues are getting covered?
I mean, I think we're seeing a much more multimedia approach to how Latino issues are being covered, which is wonderful. The hashtag, I think, is one of the greatest inventions in the last few years because you're allowed to follow topics sort of across platforms, even though it's originated in Twitter. So I think, you know, it's the direction that media is going in, and we need to embrace it while at the same time trying to hold on to longer forms, blogging, and also traditional print journalism.
Right. Well, so if you are a Latino blogger and you're struggling with the pressures of running a successful blog, what type of incentives exist to stay at it in your independent voice if there is a possibility of getting a check in the mail every week?
I think the way to do it is to be open to doing both, honestly. And that's one of the ways that I personally have survived as a blogger and as a media maker, and others are doing as well. I think it's really important to, yes, maintain that independent voice. But, you know, let's be real, media in general is not doing so great financially. And so the way to do it is to really sort of find a balance between all of them. And that's the way you're going to survive. And the incentive is being able to be authentic to yourself. But yeah, you know, getting into the media game as well.
All right. Thanks for joining us on Latino USA, Megan.
Thank you, Maria.
Megan Ortiz is the publisher of Vivir Latino. She joined us from her home in Los Angeles, California. For news updates throughout the week, like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. We are Latino USA. That's all one word. And we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. So stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Editor of News Taco, Victor Landa, joins us again for a news roundup on the latest changes in U.S. politics, this time as Republicans regroup in Florida and Arizona readdresses culturally relevant courses in schools. Welcome back to Latino USA, Victor.
Gracias. Thank you very much.
Well, Victor, a lot of people somewhat surprised with the news that Hilda Solis is stepping down as Labor Secretary, and that means that the little diversity in Obama's cabinet that did exist has pretty much vanished. Why did she decide to step down, and will a less diverse cabinet change anything?
Well, you know, the big and telling quote when she announced that she'd be leaving her position at the Department of Labor was that she was returning to the people and places she loves. So, you know, one assumes that she means that she's going to be going back to California. And the rumor mill is rampant with talk that she'll what she'll be doing next. The most repeated idea that I've been hearing is that she's going to run possibly for the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. There's even some whispering around that she'd be a good candidate for governor of California. I don't know how accurate that would be, but she's well positioned to do well in pretty much anything that she may decide to do. But it does strike a big blow to, you know, the diversity of the president's cabinet. I think that's a huge blow.
But if she does, in fact, run for this seat, does she lose the national stage while gaining quite a bit of influence that could lead to a governorship in California?
Yeah, well, it's a tit for tat, right? You know, she does lose a lot by not being on the national stage, but maybe there's something that she really wants to gain in her home state that she feels that she could be much better positioned to do as a supervisor, eventually governor.
So there's a lot of talk about a new book coming out by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and there she talks about being one of the first Latinas at the Yale Law School. That was in the early 1980s. Cristina Rodriguez now, 2013, is the first Latina to become a tenured professor at Yale Law School. Why did it take so long for this to happen at Yale? And what does this change?
Yeah, you know, it came as a surprise to me that Rodriguez was just the first tenured law professor at Yale. These are coveted positions in old traditional institutions where change comes really slowly. There was a piece in the National Journal that was published in October of last year, and it found that the nation's elite universities aren't doing so well as far as their faculty reflecting the diversity of their student body or of the country in general, for that matter. It's hard to get a good accounting of tenured professors at Ivy League colleges and universities because, you know, all of these colleges self-report, and they self-report differently as far as the diversity of their faculties. The one thing that they all have in common, though, is that they all seem to say that they're working on diversifying their faculty. One thing is the effort, and the other thing is, why is it taking so long to do that? So it was a huge surprise to me that, yeah, here it is, 2013, and Yale is just now seeing its first Latina tenured professor in their law school.
And at the same time, now we're going to return to a story that we've been following quite a bit on Latino USA, and that has to do with the school board in Tucson, Arizona. This time, they voted to lift their objection to include culturally relevant coursework as part of their core curriculum in Tucson. So this means that, in essence, there's a bit of backtracking about these ethnic studies courses that were banned in the Tucson Unified School District, and now it appears that they are going to be allowed again?
That's exactly what it means. It's a technicality, really. It means that the courses in question, like the Mexican-American Studies classes, are one step closer to being reinstated as part of the Tucson ISD's core curriculum, and that's the technicality. The classes were taken away by a state order, but that state action was then was not successful because the classes were part of a federally mandated desegregation order that was put in place like 30 years ago. So the Tucson ISD had to reinstate the classes, but they didn't reinstate them as part of the core curriculum. They reinstated them, but they objected to those classes being part of the core curriculum. And what this last action did is that they lifted that objection. So now those classes are going to be reinstated and as part of the core curriculum. So it's all kind of technical, but what it really means is that those classes are one step closer to being reinstated.
Now, a group of GOP leaders met on January 11th in Miami, a high-level meeting to talk about strategy to reach out better to Latino voters coming up in the 2014 cycle. So who's involved with this effort for Republicans to try to get the Latino vote?
Yeah, the meeting was organized by Jeb Bush and the Hispanic Leadership Network. And what they did was they wanted to discuss the, quote, Hispanic problem, unquote, and what to do about it. The agenda was to plan the Republican outreach for the 2014 election cycle. And, you know, folks like Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez, former Texas Representative Kiko Canseco, and Rosario Marin, the former U.S. Treasurer, they were all expected to be there. I believe they were all there. And it's really a political PR meeting. The GOP at present is held in very low regard among Latinos, and folks like those that were at the Miami meeting, they'd been sounding the alarm among the GOP about the Latino problem for months. So this was sort of like, I told you so, now let's do something about it meeting. There really isn't too much word about what came from it. The Hispanic Leadership Network is sort of an outside GOP group. It's not part of the inside Republican core leadership group. So we'll see what comes of it. But, you know, Jeb Bush was the leader of this one meeting and his Hispanic Leadership Network, and we'll see what comes of it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us on Latino USA, Victor.
Thanks to you, Maria.
Victor Landa is the founder and editor of News Taco. He joined us from the studios of KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. This past November, voters in three states, Maine, Maryland, and Washington, approved ballot measures in favor of gay marriage. In Oregon, supporters of same-sex marriage are working to get their own measure on the ballot by 2014, and they're reaching out to Oregon Latinos to help them do it. Jacob Lewin reports from Portland.
Just before Washington voters finished casting their ballots on the measure to permit gay marriage, young Oregon Latinos were staffing a multilingual phone bank to support the measure.
Bueno, yo me llamo Raquel y soy voluntaria con la campaña Unidos por el Matrimonio en Washington. It's okay, I speak English too. It's okay, I speak English too.
They were there as a result of groundwork by Basic Rights Oregon. The state's major gay rights organization is working with the Latino community to put a freedom to marry measure on the 2014 ballot. Basic Rights Executive Director Gina Frazzini says Latinos are the fastest growing demographic group in Oregon.
One of the things that we're sort of keenly aware of in Oregon is that we haven't engaged conversations with communities of color, Latino, African American, Native, about LGBT equality as directly as we need to. You know, like many movements, the movement for LGBT equality has been primarily led by white folks, and we haven't always brought a racial justice lens to the work that we do.
Frazzini says that Basic Rights Oregon has two goals, supporting Latino gays and lesbians and getting their votes.
We've done projects that include leadership development. We did a campaign of radio advertisements, Spanish language radio advertisements that were an education effort on building support for the freedom to marry.
Toda persona gay es parte de la familia de alguien, y como Latina, creo en amar al prójimo.
The ads feature parents of gay Latinos saying every gay person is part of someone's family. The outreach is one reason there's been a dramatic shift toward support of gay rights by Latinos. Nationally, a Pew Center survey shows 52% of Hispanics favor same-sex marriage, up from just 34% 3 years ago. Christian Baif with the immigration rights group CAUSA says part of the change is due to how gays are depicted on TV.
the media plays a key role in all this. Lately, we've been seeing in different shows in the English television and Spanish television that gay couples are portraying more as a family instead of just the clown of one show like it used to be. Right now, we're seeing shows that portray families.
The Mundo Fox Network, which recently began broadcasting in Oregon, now has a show, Los Exitosos Perez, that features a gay professional couple. Pacific University political science professor Jim Moore names one other reason that more Latinos are supporting gay rights.
Gay marriage is now really being talked about as a civil rights issue. And when you do civil rights issues for Latinos, especially with focus on immigration kinds of issues, relationships with the police in local areas, that kind of thing, civil rights issues have a real resonance with Latino voters.
On the other hand, Latinos in Oregon are disproportionately young, and young people tend to be less likely to vote. And while the Diocese of Portland says a large majority of Latinos in Oregon are still Catholic, there's also a growing number joining evangelical churches. Evangelical churches were key in supporting Measure 36, which just 8 years ago put a ban on gay marriage into the state constitution. And Christian Baef acknowledges a key element of Latino society.
We have a macho culture. We also have the golden rule as an important part of our culture as well. So to treat others as we want to be treated, not letting anybody behind, that's also something important in Latino families.
Baef says that the level of support among Latinos is now equivalent to the general population. Political science professor Jim Moore says a freedom to marry measure that's likely to be on the ballot in Oregon in 2014 would probably be close, and Latino voters could make the difference. For Latino USA, I'm Jacob Lewin.
And now for a little antojito. There's probably no piece of clothing that says Latino more than the guayabera. It's a traditional men's shirt, thought to come from Cuba, with four pockets and decorative stitching from shoulder to hem. Stately, but a bit on the plain side. At least that was before Miami shirt maker Mariano Arce got his hands on them.
When my son went to the school and he asked his friends about why they didn't use guayabera, they said, no, no, that's too ugly. That's for my grandfather, for my father.
So Arce set to work updating the shirt. He traded traditional linen for cotton and solid pastel tones for stripes, plaids, even polka dots.
Well, people love it.
Now, he says, men, young and old, wear his guayaberas to parties and to clubs.
And people feel elegant without using a suit.
It takes a whole day for Arce to make one guayabera because he works by hand. And he'll only make 10 shirts in any one style, max. That's because his customers want their guayaberas to be unique. Arce will even put the customer's name on the shirt buttons and the customer's signature on the cuffs. But there's only one marketing problem. Sometimes a client won't tell anyone else who made his one-of-a-kind guayabera. But you can see some photos of them on our website at latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA, if you're cruising the boulevards in San Diego, you might spot some unique ladies. They took me for a ride I'll never forget.
Better than any roller coaster.
Lady lowriders on the move. That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Much of the country is dealing with ice and cold winds right now, but Southern Californians are enjoying balmy temperatures in the mid-60s. Perfect weather for getting out and working on your lowrider before cruising season begins in earnest. Since its beginnings in the 1940s and 50s, lowriding has been a man's passion. The cars and the music, the tattoos and the pinups of busty ladies. But these days, women are also seen cruising the boulevards, driving their own souped-up cars. When I heard that there was an official Ladies Lowrider Club in San Diego, I knew I wanted to meet them. Because lowriders have always fascinated me, even though, truth be told, I've never been in one until today. Underneath the noisy elevated highway, in the parking lot of San Diego's famous Chicano Park, I meet two members of the unique Ladies Lowrider Club.
Hi!
Hi, nice to meet you. My name is Pat.
Un abrazo.
53-year-old Patricia Gutierrez is wearing jeans and a black t-shirt. She has tattoos on her arms and long, dark hair. She's standing proudly next to her 1990 Lincoln Town Car. But this town car is painted a bright metallic orange and is slung just inches from the ground. As I'm about to learn with lowriders, the color of the car is everything.
You have to walk up to my car and look at it and tell me what colors you see.
First, it's orange. Oh my God, I'm seeing some green.
Yes,
get out.
Keep on coming. Keep on coming.
But it's orange. Right. It's the reflection of the sun. This is freaking me out.
Yes, and in between the patterns that are up there, it depends on the time, but mostly towards the evening, you can see a maroon and blue color go back and forth. It's in the paint. The car is an orange, but I can't tell you what color orange it is because a lot of people are after this color. It's what's on top of the orange that makes it look different.
9 years ago, Patricia decided she'd had enough of being excluded from all male lowrider clubs. And so she and a few San Diego-based women created their own club just for them.
What does your license plate say?
UNIQLDY. It says Unique Lady.
Unique Lady.
Mm-hmm. And this is my famous saying. I'm always saying that, always a lady. So I kind of named my car Always a Lady.
Just across the parking lot, 51-year-old Sherry Yafuso, also wearing jeans and her black club t-shirt, is standing next to her car. This one is a 1985 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme painted a shiny cobalt blue. And if you think a car is just a car, not true when it comes to women and their lowriders.
If someone was to ask you what a lowrider signifies,
mine would be, it's a canvas. It's a work of art. You know, you put all your ideas and just what you like and you put it out on your car's personality. I just love it because I can put all my ideas out there. They're all in my head and then you see them all out there. And then we go to car shows. Plus we could be just sitting in the park and people come up and all the acknowledgement we get is really cool.
For Patricia, her lowrider has become a source of liberation.
When I get in my car is my little space, is my little world. And I put whatever type of music I want to play, whatever I feel like listening to. It's like the greatest escape ever. It's the best feeling. It's the best high, so to speak. It's like better than coffee. Way better than coffee, and I love coffee.
And so, in order to get into the real lowrider mood, we had to get in the car and hit the music.
Ready? And we go all the way up in the back.
And then Patricia hits the switches for the heavy-duty hydraulic pumps that make lowriders literally hop up and down and go side to side.
So we gotta go with the music. Now you know how I have the music on.
Been on a roller coaster in a long time. That is better than any roller coaster.
Cool. I'm glad you liked it.
Now I get why people like it.
Yeah.
Lowriders and the people who drive them have often been stereotyped in the media, which is exactly what Patricia and Sherry love to demystify.
As far as feeling like it's like I'm being targeted, I think I've been like that all my life. Being female, being Hispanic, Latino, however you want to, you know, term it. I know who I am. I know what I represent. I know what I look like.
And I constantly remind people not to judge the book by the cover. Don't assume that because I decided to have tattoos on my body or I decide to drive this particular type of vehicle that I'm lesser a person than you are. And I make it clear to everybody. I don't have a problem speaking my mind.
I like that we can change the image of the lowrider where we're not all gang members and drug users. So that's my life. That's what I do.
Both Sherry and Patricia are mothers. In fact, Patricia is a grandmother. But if you happen to drive up next to either the bright orange or cobalt blue lowriders they own, don't be surprised if you see these women hopping to prove something. Lowrider culture is a competitive one, and these women are the new kids on the block.
You're saying that there's like a whole street communication that happens when you hit the hydraulics. Another lowrider may think that you're basically, what, disrespecting them?
Yes. If you're rolling out on the street and you're hitting switches on somebody, you're basically challenging them. Being that I'm female and I start doing that, then there's going to be, oh, well, I'm going to have to challenge her. I'm going to have to go against her because now that's a reputation thing. And it's also a guy thing because it's like, you know, you don't want a girl out there being able to hop the car higher than yours.
And while the Unique Ladies is one of the few women's lowrider clubs in the country, I swear that they can hop their car as high as any man. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, call our listener line at 646-571-1228. That's 646-571-1228. Please tell us how to say your name clearly and where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Michael Simon Johnson and Manoli Wetherill at NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring, with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.